This is Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, a podcast by prosecutors, law enforcement, victims, real people with real experience. Welcome back. As a lawyer, I want to note that all of the opinions expressed on Inside the Bar are the opinions of the speaker. They should not be held against anyone else, and certainly should not be used as grounds for any sort of lawsuits or anything like that. The idea here is to create a platform where prosecutors and law enforcement have an opportunity to give their view on what is going on in the world and what has gone on in some of these cases. So, with that in mind, let's start. Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt is a study of violent crimes and the prosecution of those cases. The content may be disturbing for many. There may also be the occasional use of curse words. Listeners are warned. This is Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt, Episode 3. You will recall that Deb Kirkland played an integral role in the trial of the first Jim Williams case. But why are there so many trials? It's a question that Depp spent a lot of time researching for his book, and he shared much of what he uncovered with me. Join us. We are back with Depp Kirkland. This is round two.
Oh, boy.
And I'm just explaining for myself that we actually came back last weekend, and some of the stuff that we talked about did not record. So we're going to try to cover that. Where we ended with the recording that I have was after the first appeal. And you mentioned when you came today that there were some thoughts that you had about that first appeal that maybe didn't get mentioned the last go around. So let's talk about that. You've had some time to look over stuff again. What was it that jumped out at you?
Well, what jumped out at me was the manipulation of the situation, because what I realized after I reviewed this, there's this issue of these reports and things that were said and recorded by Corporal Anderson in this May report, or the May killing, that referred back to this April incident at the house when Danny was supposedly firing off this gun and all of that we talked about. Mm-hmm. Well, the allegation then, when before the jury was charged and we went into the judge's chambers, was that there was something in the May report, the May supplemental report by Corporal Anderson, that referred back to April that contradicted his testimony he'd given in the trial about what they found when they went upstairs and Danny Hanford was laying across the bed and there was supposedly a bullet, he'd fired off a bullet into the floor. And it threw a carpet into the floor and there was some mark and there was questions about, they're trying to prove he's nuts and he would shoot you tomorrow because he shot you at something else, or shot at a tree yesterday. So that being their point of view, they cross-examined Anderson quite a bit on that. And he referred in May to the earlier April incident. And this bullet hole, supposedly bullet hole, I still put quotes around that, that they went upstairs and they were shown a hole in the carpet and a marking in the floor that Williams said was a bullet hole. And in the May report and supplemental, Anderson had referred to it as a fresh bullet hole. Now, the point is, he referred to what he put in his report, what Williams had told him, because he wasn't there when the shot was fired, if it was fired at all. So it became this issue about, had Danny Hanford fired this gun into the floor in April? Now, the allegation it wasn't even an allegation. When we went into the chambers before the jury was charged, all that Cook asked was, well, we were thinking that probably maybe Anderson had referred to the April incident in his May report, and we're just wondering if there's anything in the May report, which they supposedly did not have, because they weren't entitled to it, that contradicted anything he just testified to.
Right.
And, you know, we went through all of that. Where I said, well, I don't think so, but the best way is to find out is to look at it. It was right there in the file. And the cook says, right. Nah, never mind. It's okay. Off we go. So that's the point.
Which, again, would be induced error if it's error at all because you've waived it.
I think so.
Right. I think so, too.
Later, the Supreme Court would find later that he had made, in fact, a formal request for the May report. I don't know how that's a request, but they reinterpreted it. But the point that I went back to was, and of course, I know now what Cook was doing. He had lost the trial. There's no way. He had his expert witness had disintegrated on the stand. There was no way he'd won this case. So he needed something for appeal to put in his back pocket.
Sure.
So here's this thing he thinks he has. Well, when we go to into the appellate process, I'm not thinking anything of this. Nobody's thinking anything about this.
And you didn't write appeals back then. Y'all had it.
I did not.
Right. So somebody wrote appeals for you. But that is something that changed, actually. And you may or may not know this. When David Locke became chief assistant, he was insistent that all of us write our own appeals.
Wow.
I think was good in some respects for those of us who can write and not so good for those of us who can't. So, you know, it's an interesting question.
It's a different way of doing it. And prior to David doing it, prior to Spencer Lawton going in as DA, they also had a dedicated person who handled appeals. They know the process. They know how to write it. They do the research. They like doing the research. And another thing, it puts a fresh set of eyes on the case, to be honest.
True.
From the beginning. And
true.
You can look at it and say, here's something I saw that maybe we could argue this way or that way. You're trying a case, you're trying facts, you know, and you get to the legal side, they have to have some legal argument to overturn a case, and it's not always fact-based, because typically the fact base isn't going to change the decision on appeal. It's going to be some legal argument.
Right, but again, if you don't know the law, and you haven't bothered to learn the law, you aren't making a good record. And I think that was part of David's thinking, is that you need to learn what kinds of objections are being raised, and what kind of record you need to have. And you know, it worked for me, but you know, and it doesn't work for everybody, and you know, whatever. And again, it's just a different approach. Anyway, so David was your appeals person.
David was our appeals person.
So he took over for the motions for new trial that always get filed.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's a standard thing. They all, the defense always goes back and says, "Well, motion for new trial. We want a new trial because of A, B, C, and D." Now you're basically asking the same court that just tried your case to overrule itself and decide that it made error, it created error. It very seldom, if ever, happens. But
let me
they
ask
make
this
it.
Question, and it is now, and I know I'm interrupting, I'm sorry. It is now an enormous part of the motion for new trial and appellate process to talk about ineffective assistance of counsel. Was that as much of a thing back then or not? I mean,
I think it's a case dependent question, because it depends on what just happened. And I suppose if you have an egregious case where it's obvious, if you went back to, I guess, Charlie Manson Irving Kinnaird could probably have alleged. The guy was a mess. His counsel was a mess. He totally didn't know what he was doing. Or he didn't know what he was doing, and he was crazy on purpose. We don't know. But if it's in front of you and the judge is looking at it, may want to say, you know, perhaps we should have this retried with somebody else. But I never saw it happen, but then I wasn't around that long. In that case, but it could relate to this in an interesting way.
Okay.
Because what happens during the appeal, after this thing about the May incident and the report, is no one's thinking about it. It goes up on appeal. David Locke, yes, was the one who handled all of our appellate work. So he is the one who's looking at these filings. So there's the motion for new trial. It's denied. Then we get a notice of appeal. The notice of appeal is filed, and they allege in there what they thought was wrong.
Okay. And just to be clear, that motion for new trial did not mention this.
No. No complaint.
You know, complaint about the May report.
No complaint. No, nothing about it. Not
raised. How about that first appeal?
Nothing.
Appellate brief.
No mention of it.
Then what happened?
And David will have. David's more precise about this, but there are a series of appeals. There's a notice of appeal. There's the first appellate brief. And it was either in that first appellate brief by the defense, or it was in their reply to one of David's replies to their appellate brief, that they first raised the issue of this report and this contradiction, supposedly, between the report, what Anderson wrote in the report, and what he said on the stand. Okay. First time it was raised. And it,
there are rules about that, by the way. You've got to raise it in front of the trial court,
you
right?
You have to raise it in front of the trial court or you waive it.
Right.
They hadn't raised it in front of the trial court. They put it in their appellate brief, okay, and stated it as fact and complained about it. And they said in there, this is what I get back to where I started, was they said, well, we just wonder that maybe in writing his May supplemental referring back to April, Anderson might have had cause to say something about this April incident. Okay, that's a little nebulous to start with. Then the appellate briefs start to cross paths. This one, then reply to that one, reply to that one. Then as those briefs are filed, the story changes. Then it becomes, well, we had a source within the district attorney's office. Now, I don't know who that would have been. I have ideas if that person existed, which I don't think they did, that they had received an anonymous phone call. And Cook says, this was before Anderson testified, mm-hmm. which was on Friday. Now, the meeting that we had in chambers with Judge Oliver about this thing where he made this nebulous request for the report was on the next Tuesday. So apparently they had some anonymous phone call telling them that there was something in Anderson's report that contradicted his testimony, but didn't say anything about it. Now here we are on appeal. And then what happens is they go to oral argument. Mm-hmm. And Bobby Lee Cook stands up in front of the Supreme Court and starts testifying to new facts.
What new facts were there?
The new facts were that not only was he certain that the May referral to April, and I keep getting that all jumbled around, the May reference to April was contradictory of Anderson's testimony, but that they knew that they had been told that specifically, and eventually he goes through a number of iterations to his story. He gets to the point that Bobby Lee Cook tells the Supreme Court that he had the report all along. He had had it when he made the complaint. It wasn't a complaint. When he made that nebulous reference in Judge Oliver's chambers to, we're just wondering if maybe there's anything in this report, and I had said we should just get it and look at it. He already had it. He told the Supreme Court, I had the report. If he had the report, and this is what gets back to your question about ineffective assistance of counsel. All right, mm-hmm. here we are. It's the end of the trial, trial one. Mm-hmm. It's fairly clear to me, though I didn't, you never know with a jury, that there was no defense to this thing. I thought, and I'm sure Cook had tried 300 murder trials. He knew that. He knew he'd lost this case. And he needed something. The point is, his client is sitting out there in a courtroom, and a jury is about to be charged to possibly convict this man of murder or involuntary manslaughter or whatever. He's about to be put before a jury. And supposedly now, Cook says, now months later, that, oh, well, I had this report, and it contradicted what Corporal Anderson said. He went even further. He said that he had been told by his anonymous source, which didn't exist in my opinion, that Anderson knew that what was in his report in May contradicted what he had said on the stand, and that he had changed his testimony. All right, I know I'm sounding very dramatic, but he had never testified. So I don't know how he could have changed his testimony, because this is the first case, the first time he'd ever testified on the subject, that Anderson, in fact, had lied on the stand on purpose.
Well, and Anderson was actually cross-examined by the defense.
Yes, he was.
About that bullet hole, and he said it was a bullet hole, right?
Yes. And what happened in the May report, he referred to, he used the word fresh.
Right, right. That's what the hang-up is whether he said fresh on cross-examination or not.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and we could jump to the second trial when he is cross-examined and examined on direct about this very thing. And he said, well, why did I put that? Well, it's because that's what Williams told me. He right. wasn't the source of the information.
Right.
Anderson was only writing down what he had been told.
Right.
And it was no big deal, and it never was mentioned again. But right now, they're saying, oh, Corporal Anderson lied on the stand because there's this fresh word. And we had the report all along. Now, if Cook had the report all along, and it's before the jury has been charged, and he thinks it would have created a different result, and he could go in and destroy the state's case with it, for him not to say he had it and not to walk back into the courtroom and take that thing and cross and put Anderson back on the stand, I would think maybe that's why he wasn't there in the second trial, because...
Right, it's an interesting question, because if it was so material, and of course that is part of my frustration with the reversal and the first appeal, and you know, again, I'm coming at it just as a lawyer way after the fact, but when you read it, you know, there's a suggestion that it is a suppression of something material, and that's what Brady is all about.
Right.
It's like you can't
hit it.
Right, well, it's not just that you hit it, but that you hit it and it was something that was meaningful.
Right.
And so the idea that bullet hole versus fresh bullet hole is meaningful, again, if they had it and they knew about it, they had the opportunity to reopen. Well, first of all, to look at the report in chambers, and second, to let's reopen the evidence.
They could have put Corporal Anderson right back on the stand.
Before the jury got charged, anything else.
And it would have made the problem, and let's assume for a moment that there was something material and important in that thing that contradicted Anderson, it would have made the prosecution look horrible.
Sure.
To have a jury brought back in and said, oh, we have to go back now because they've done something evil. And it would create, the very end of the trial, the worst possible thing.
Now, for a prosecution, sure,
For the prosecution. What's fascinating is, and here we get to the appeal. So, the Supreme Court says, to your point, this was not material.
Right.
This would not have created a different result.
Right.
Number two, we do not find that Corporal Anderson committed perjury.
Right.
That didn't happen.
Right.
In fact, if those two things are true, and I'm not even sure about the perjury, but the fact that this error, if it was an error, was not material. In other words, it means it would not have changed the result of the trial.
Right.
You're supposed to, everybody's supposed to go home.
Right.
However, they said, they created a new rule, and they just said, we are going to reverse this because we cannot countenance this terrible thing the prosecution did by hiding this evidence.
Right, and in fact, I think in one of the later Williams appeals, they even say that's not a thing.
Well, that did happen later in one of the other appeals, and then a crazy back-and-forth thing that took place about back-and-forth of disqualification motions by the prosecutors. It went to the Supreme Court. It got to be a mess about politics, but what it also did was it reopened and had them re-examine the decision in the first appeal.
Right.
Same court, different justices, but the same court. And they did go back, and just as an aside in that other debacle of a crazy fight that took place at the Supreme Court, they said, oh, by the way, we have looked at this, and there was no, I forget the words, it was something that we'd done to the fact-finding process that was so egregious that they had to reverse the first one. They basically said, no, that didn't happen.
Right, so you know, we went through all of this drama for nothing.
And that report, by the way, never came up in another, it was touched on briefly.
By the prosecution.
By the prosecution, which they could have done in the first place.
If they knew.
If they knew, but they didn't know. We didn't know. So, and another thing that I thought of after that, I thought, you know, it's interesting to me, because if you look at, and this could have, I guess, been brought up in argument anyway, but if you look at this April incident when Danny was crazy and firing, shooting trees outside and then went upstairs, and then William says, you know, you'll never take him alive, and he's up there, he's got a gun, and he's fired it into the floor. And then they go up and they look at the floor and they see a hole in the carpet and they see a mark in the floor, but they find no bullet. All right, now, jump forward to May, when Danny Hansford is shot and killed.
Mm-hmm.
The final shot that was fired into Hansford was fired into his back as he lay on the floor. That bullet went completely through a body and embedded itself in the oak flooring, and I was there when Detective Reagan had to pry it out with a knife.
Right.
Now, you're telling me that this bullet somehow went through a carpet and somehow disappeared.
Yeah.
So I still have, you know, questions about that.
Right,
of course. That's neither here nor there.
Right.
The point is, the way the process went is that something was up about this case, and that's why, you know, I think I said in my book that but for perhaps myself or Spencer Lawton or Judge Oliver himself not having stopped and pulled that report out at the time, gave rise to 4 murder trials, 9.5 years of something, a movie, a book, another book, and tourists swarming Savannah all about midnight. None of that would have happened.
It's an interesting question, definitely. There's no doubt about that.
Would have been another murder case, and off we go.
Right. I mean, we have murders in Savannah.
It happens.
So let's start talking about Williams 2. And oh, you boy. Were gone by then.
I was gone. Yep. I had gone to Atlanta to work for the Governor Harris.
But you have been through the transcript. And again, you know, I know that there are a lot of differences in testimony and those kinds of things. And I do think that it is worthwhile to go through, if for those who are very interested in all of that nuance, to read your book, because, you know, there's a lot of very specific stuff. You know, obviously we're talking about it, but I don't necessarily want to get into a lot of details about or every detail, because there's a lot. When we're talking about Williams 2, it comes back new lawyer, new story, is right. The way you describe it.
Right.
So tell me, what jumped out at you when you read the transcript of Williams 2? I mean, big stuff.
Well, the main thing, I guess, was Williams trying to finesse the relationship. Because originally in the first trial, he wanted nothing to do with there being any kind of a romantic, physical, sexual relationship between him and the victim. Those things aren't good because that's the source of a lot of killings, as you know.
Right.
Domestic, you know, anger, jealousy, whatever it is. In the second trial, Williams admitted to it, sort of. He admitted to it more openly in the third trial, but in the second trial. But he made it out as if it was not a big deal. And there was comments, testimony to the effect that, well, he had his girlfriend, I had mine. I never saw any sign of a girlfriend for Jim Williams. That's, you know, it's fine. He can do what he wants. But that it was just a casual thing. It's just sex, and that's just a thing. It's a human thing. It's no big deal. But he did admit it, because if he didn't, the testimony that came out in rebuttal by the state in the first case about that relationship really hurt him.
Right.
Because you could see what this thing was really about. So we tried to diffuse that a little bit. So that was unusual.
Right.
Other thing that was just fascinating to me, without getting into the detail, and we could talk about a couple of instances that are examples without mm-hmm. getting into every, because yes, going back through that transcript, and this is something that people, you certainly understand this.
Sure.
Going back after the fact, looking at every single piece of evidence, I looked at everything the DA's office had, Spencer Lawton had in his attic, the transcripts, reading them carefully. You're getting to see, and when you do it all at one time, mm-hmm. though it took a long time, you see the changes, and you're able to sit and study it and say, oh my gosh, that question, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. Let me give you one example. Mm-hmm. They made, of course, you have new lawyers, right?
Right.
So you had Sonny Seiler, Frank W., Sonny Seiler, and Austin Katz, and the other guy.
Don Samuel.
From the Garland firm, who were, you know, they were probably the biggest criminal firm.
Oh, they're still a big deal.
Are they still?
Yeah.
They were at the time, I think, probably the preeminent criminal defense firm in the mm-hmm. Southeast, maybe more than that. So what was so obvious from the get-go was the attention to what I would call minutia, but anything, whatever it was, anything to create confusion, because when the facts don't work for you, you need new facts.
Right.
And right there, they had the transcript of the first trial, you could see, how do I deal with this thing on his pants leg? So all of a sudden, you've got expert witnesses coming in. And you had one in the first case, Joe Burton, but he couldn't pull the cart by himself. So they had new ones coming in from Dallas, two other guys, and trying to create chaff. And if you fly an airplane, you know what that is. If you're in combat, you release chaff because it will help to deflect the missile, because the missile will look at that stuff. It's just stuff you get out into the air to confuse a missile when it's trying to shoot you down.
Sure. Muddy the water.
Muddy the water.
Right.
Create as much smoke as you can. One example I'll give you. And this is a chance to look at things. You have a chance to look at things slowly in process. When I go back and they went into something with Dr. Dreffen, who performed an autopsy and blood analysis and all that, about Hansford and the fact that his blood alcohol content was 0.9 at the autopsy, done from blood, not urine, but from blood.
Right.
And oh my gosh, that was 12 hours later. It wasn't done until 12 hours later. They harp on that. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're in court and these things are happening, you know, you respond to anything that you can that makes sense to respond to, but this is, who knows where they're going with this.
Right, and you don't want to go down rabbit holes,
no,
right?
No, you don't want to follow them, because right. That's what they're trying to do, is to make it about something else.
Right.
But when you have a chance to sit back and look at it, and then, of course, I also am sitting at a computer where I can go say, well, let me go look this up, because something's fishy about that.
Right.
All right, so I find out, oh, wait a minute, I knew this. They're suggesting, obviously, that, well, if he was 0.09, which at the time was under the DUI law in Georgia, it's changed,
right.
But
right.
At the time it was 0.10, so he was slightly one-tenth under, a hundredth under the limit for a DUI, but it was 12 hours later. So how drunk must he have been when this happened? Well, dead people don't metabolize alcohol.
Right.
It could, in fact, decrease, not increase over time.
Right.
So there's one that just flies right by. And you're thinking, wait a minute. But are you going to spend time to go back and do that? And that's why the book is so different. Because somebody who's interested in this stuff, and they really are interested in this stuff, it's fascinating.
It
became fascinating to me, or I would not have written the book. That's
sure.
What got me going, was I started seeing these things.
Right.
Wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, and it doesn't matter, exactly.
And it doesn't matter, but it matters to them, because they need to create this new trial, that's what I say. And William's story changes. His story changes about when Hansford came into the room. There's, for example, there's something that never got addressed that I could see. There was a live 9mm round found in the room.
That became important, right?
Well, I think it's important.
Sorry.
It never really was explained in any of these trials. There was a live 9mm round in there, which meant it was cross-examined about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that came out was, well, why would that be there? Well, what happens is, as you know, if you've got an automatic, semi-automatic pistol, and you rack the slide, and there's already a round in the chamber, it will eject the round.
Right.
So that's an action you would take if you're not sure your gun is cocked and ready to fire.
Right.
Okay, now here's the problem for Williams.
All of his.
He said, all of his problems. His story was, Danny Hansford was in a rage. He came into that room, wasn't a split second, that he walked around the thing and said the famous line about, I'm leaving, you know, you're leaving tonight, I might be leaving tonight, and fired at him. Did he take time to stop? Did he cock the... Oh, no. Weapons were cocked and ready. Now, I can't believe they were cocked and ready. They were in a house. You shouldn't be. But he said they were. Not even a second went by. Somebody had to cock that weapon. Now, the problem with it is, if Danny Hansford was the one that fired the weapon that was on the floor, supposedly he had used, he would have stopped and racked the slide on it. It would have ejected that shell and then turned and said whatever he said. That couldn't happen. It's inconsistent with Williams' testimony. It's not inconsistent if Williams did that later himself, because he had time.
Right. So the live round was actually someplace that was much... It was far from the desk.
Absolutely.
And the action's all around the desk.
Yes.
Everything else is pretty much around the desk. The ejected shell casings, those kinds of things. This live round was It was almost passed, behind Danny's
it was
body.
Passed, it was yeah, passed hands near, toward the fireplace.
Right.
It was completely, it was over there. Whoever, wherever that round, whenever that round was ejected, it came, it was done over there. Not, well, basically where Hansford's body was found, not behind the desk where William says he was.
Right.
It came, it had to have come from the pistol on the floor.
Let me ask this, and I think you mention it in your book, and I'm not sure. I got lucky in a case I had once that there were enough markings on a live round that had been through that right. circumstance that you could tell which weapon it had cycled through.
Didn't check.
Didn't happen. They didn't check.
I don't know that they didn't check. I don't know if they checked it, but they did not. It was not.
And it's hit or miss point. With something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't always do that. It right. depends on the weapon. They don't all leave marks. And, again,
and you both, you have 2 9mm Lugers.
These are Lugers from God knows who. And
right,
like,
exactly.
Modern weapons are so different. I don't know if they could do that then, but there was testimony that they did check for fingerprints on the clip. Well, it's
right.
a magazine.
Right.
They call it a clip, but it's a magazine. And on the rounds themselves, and they didn't
right.
find any fingerprints on any of that.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. So, and I was just curious about it. So this live round becomes kind of a hot potato for him, doesn't it?
I think it was. I don't think it was ever really, I don't think it was ever really raised as an issue in the case because there was so much else.
Right.
There was so much else, you know, and in the second trial, of course.
Well, and but you talk about so much else. You're talking about so much else that showed that this was a staged scene.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think we could, you know, we could talk later, we'll get to trial four, but about how, you know, the tendency to just lose your motivation after a while doing the same. It's like any sports analogy.
Right.
Beating the same team four times is very difficult if you're roughly equivalent.
Right.
It's hard because
right.
getting up for that game the fourth time is so difficult. And I think sometimes you can just let things go. Because particularly when you think...
Well, it wasn't important last time.
No.
You know,
and
yeah.
particularly if you've won.
Yeah.
I mean, so
yeah.
far, there have been... When you, by the time you get to trial four, there have been three verdicts. Only one person we'll talk about who did not agree to convict this man.
Right.
So, yeah, you should be confident. Look, gravity... I say this in the book. Gravity isn't going to change.
Right.
And the problem for Williams was... that is the physical evidence in this case. It was damning. I don't think, and I would say, I said this at the trial, I think there's no way that his story could be true. It couldn't have happened.
Right, and this live round that becomes a thing was indicative of that staging, right?
Absolutely.
Based on where it was.
Absolutely.
How do you think it got there?
Well, I'll tell you, I did do this in the book. I did this in the book at the end, and you will remember it when you get to that. But because
mm-hmm.
I said, look, for a reader to have sat through all of this detail and
mm-hmm.
all of this about what might have happened, well, I feel like I have an obligation to tell you what I think happened.
Right.
Okay. And I laid out what I think really happened in that room.
Right. But specific to this live
round. Specific to this live round. Williams shot and killed Danny Hansford when Danny jumped up out of a chair, knocked the chair over.
Danny was unarmed.
Danny Dunny was yeah. unarmed.
Right.
They were having a little bit of a fight, which they did quite often. That happened. Williams lost it, and he pulled his Luger out, and he shot him. And then he walked around, and he shot him the last time. He shot him three times. The last time, straight down through the floor, into
right.
the floor. Okay. Then he called his friend, Joe Goodman, all right, told him to get down there right away. Then he called his lawyers. Then about 36 minutes later, he called the police.
Right.
Okay. In between, he had to figure out what to do because now he's got a dead man on the floor. So he goes and he gets another Luger, which he had, and he comes into the office, which is interesting. Because you'd have to look at the diagram, and you've seen it, but the
right.
diagram. If you walk into the study, as soon as you cross the threshold of that study, you have a clear shot at Williams from the door.
Right.
It's wide open. He's 8 feet away, maybe, to 8-10 feet away. But, okay, the body is over here because he's already dead, and he's on the other side of the desk. He's around the desk. Hansford is on the floor. So Williams can't shoot the fake shot from the doorway.
Right.
So he walks around with the new Luger to mm-hmm. where Hanford's body is, but to where his head is, which is another
problem
glaring mistake, big problem for him.
Right.
To where his head is,
mm-hmm.
and he racks the slide on the other weapon, mm-hmm. and it ejects the live round. And then he fires the shot off at his desk, and it ricochets, and that's the shot he says was fired by Hanford to at
right.
him. That's what he did.
Right.
And that's why the live round is on the floor.
Where
it is.
Right.
If he'd walked around, if Hanford or Williams, either one, had come around that desk in a fury with an already prepared and cocked and loaded weapon and fired it instantly, there's no source for that live round.
Well, and where the live round could not have been fired, if Danny had been, like, you know, standing where the chair is.
Couldn't be.
It wouldn't be there.
No. They went up and left. They do know from that weapon which direction that round would have gone around with the cartridge typically that's ejected. Mm-hmm. You know, after it's fired, goes up and left. Where that one would have gone, I don't know, but it's over there almost by the fireplace. So it was more where someone would have been if they walked into the room, still facing that way, cock the weapon, and then turn around. That's mm-hmm. where it would have been.
Okay. Okay. All right, so how does this become a thing in Williams 2?
All of this becomes... these experts show up, and it becomes...
These are the Texas people.
These are the Texas people.
Okay.
Show up. Now, Joe Burton's still there. The Texas people show up, and they're trying to get at the gunshot residue test. So they testify to all of these tests that this fellow did, Stone had did back in Dallas in his lab. And he had done things that were, I don't know, he says, well, I took this weapon, he happened to have another weapon out there. Now, it's not the same weapon. Okay. But he fires this weapon. He then goes in his office and does paperwork. And then he comes back and checks his hand to see that. And none of these things are facts in this case. But he goes through the scenarios of all these tests he did.
So this is a hypothetical that has nothing to do with
the facts. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the book and in the little talk I do about lawyer games and what people will do, there is a thing about here's what the defense is trying to do, and I get it. Because they're saying this is a circumstantial evidence case. Okay. Well, typically they are, because nobody's...
There is a person who's going to testify, and that's Jim Williams.
Williams is going to testify. It's a direct evidence. But other than that, so he's going to say that it didn't happen that way, that the way that the physical evidence says it did. So what they have to come up with, because what you've got is you've got a hand of Hanford that is shaped in a really, really strange way, as if it had been under his body. It's covered in blood. The pommel of it is covered in blood. There is a microscopic speck found on the handle of the Luger under his hand.
Speck of blood.
A speck of blood that Dr. Howard, the prosecution's expert and head of the crime lab, testifies was detected by benzidine, barely. As he pointed out, benzidine detects blood in parts per billion. So it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, this gun that supposedly this fellow was holding has no blood on it. But his hand is filled with blood. His hand is shaped the wrong way. He is at the wrong end of the desk because Williams didn't think when he went in, and I say he did, went in and faked the shot from that corner of the desk,
right.
Southwest corner, that Hanford's feet were at the other end. Well, Dr. Burton, their expert, had already testified that Hanford was hit the first time, severed his aorta, he dropped immediately, he didn't move.
Right.
Well, how did he get to the other end of the desk if he fired from this end? So he's got the body's at the wrong end of the desk, the blood in the hand, the blood on the gun, and the paper debris from the final shot is on the top of the Luger that Williams put down.
Right.
Which he had to have put down first.
Right.
So you've got this evidence, and there is nothing they can do about it. Now, what are they trying to do? They can present what we call another hypothesis that might explain this evidence. And to your point, what is supposed to be is a reasonable hypothesis.
Right.
Saying the moon was made of cheese and therefore hands, but that doesn't make any sense. So they are trying to create clouds of evidence, just anything they can come up with. So you've got, for example, Mr. Stone from Dallas Crime Lab, who mm-hmm. says he did this. He checked, he did another one. He had some blood left over in the case at the crime lab. So he took a rag and soaked it in this blood that he had. He fired his weapon.
There's an argument that's tampering with evidence. I'm sorry.
Well, it's creating evidence. It doesn't.
Well, right, but taking blood from another case,
why has he got blood hanging around? I don't know, but he had some blood hanging around. And, I mean, he could have been, you know, he could say, well, I had blood from somewhere else. But he got a bloody rag. He fires the weapon, then rubs his hand with the bloody rag, and then he tests for GSR residue. And, I can't find much. Well, in cross-examination, bless us all for Kathy Aldridge, who isn't with us, but she's, she was something else. And I'll tell you what, she gets stoned on cross-examination. Well, is there any evidence that this kind of thing happened in this case? Well, no. He used a diagram.
And why do we care?
And why do we care? Again, a diagram that was wrong.
Right.
Not to scale. People in the wrong place. Well, is this a diagram? Well, no, I didn't. Same thing with Burton. Well, I didn't really review it. I didn't really look at it. So it's deceptive. These are things that are not real. They're not part of this case. They're not based on the evidence in this case.
Right.
Same thing with the other expert that was actually Stone's boss, who came from Dallas, about the chair. We get to the chair with the pants leg and the chair.
There is a lot of weirdness about this chair in this version of the trial.
Now, I'll tell you what Burton said in the beginning, in the first case. Burton said in the first trial.
Right, and we did actually cover some of that.
He said, well, it does look a little strange sitting on his leg like that.
Right.
But, I couldn't explain it, so I didn't really pay much attention to it. It's the key to the case. That chair could not be on this man's pants leg and is far up over his body. If he was at the other end of that desk firing a weapon at Williams, could not have happened. So what happens? They bring an expert in. You got to explain this chair.
Right.
They had not explained it in the first trial. Right. They knew that if that chair doesn't move, if they can't figure it out, some explanation for it. So two things happened. One, you mentioned earlier in our first session about the herd of elephants in the room, there were people wandering around. Okay, they were not. But the second thing they did was they brought an expert in,
mm-hmm.
Stone's boss, also from the crime lab in Houston, in Dallas. He testifies that he's not surprised that the chair ended up where it ended up.
And his explanation is what exactly?
He never explained what that meant. He says, well, the person's shot, they could be flailing around, they could have they could be this, could be that. I'm not surprised. So I would say, I would like to have seen him demonstrate how that could happen. I'd have gotten a chair, so you show me how that you could do that. Do it. Make it happen in the courtroom. Can't do it.
Right.
But he was not asked to do that, because it was so outrageous and stupid that it didn't make any sense. Then they bring, it might have been him, they talk about, it was in cross-examination in one of the prosecutions, I think Drafton, they talk about this, what I call the spastic chicken example. They bring this up with Drafton, and Drafton's such a nice guy, he just agrees with them. Like, well, yeah, I've heard about that. This is spasmodic movement. And they say, it's like a chicken. If a chicken has its head cut off, it can run around the barnyard for, a while.
That doesn't happen with humans, does it?
It doesn't happen with humans. And I also, as I mentioned in the book, I said, but if you shoot the chicken three times with a 9mm, the same thing's not going to happen.
Right.
Chicken's going down.
Right.
So they're not based on the evidence in the case.
Well, and they're not biologically similar. I mean, you've got a whole bunch of stuff going on there.
So I think that's the point you asked about all the detail. It's not the detail, it's the amount of it.
Right.
They go back to the gunshot thing. They go back to the gunshot residue test, and they talk about this and that, and things that are out in life, and things, GSR generally, they don't talk about this case. The reason this case was so unique, and Spencer will probably tell you that he wishes he'd never gone into the GS, down the GSR road. I disagreed with him. I still think it's valid. It's very valid. When you've got the head of the state crime lab and the chief firearms tester for the state crime lab telling you this man did not fire that weapon.
Right, and I want to touch on that in just a second, but go ahead.
And here's why. It's because the levels on both ends, the levels of GSR given off by this particular gun was so outrageous and so extreme. And the levels on Danny Hansford's hand of these three elements were so negative, they were virtually zero.
Right.
Even below what Randy Rydell testified, even in one case, below what you would expect to find on a person in life walking around.
Right. And so that's something I wanted to touch on, too, right. Because gunshot residue has been and you know, continues to be somewhat... it's not as meaningful in a lot of cases. And you know, in talking to
the folks... Well, most cases it's not.
Well, and yeah. Part of the reason... Right. And it's not because a negative doesn't mean anything. It's more because a positive doesn't mean anything. You know, because what the current thinking is that... You know, your levels on your hand, if you get shot and you do the thing that most people do, which is, you know, their hand goes to the gunshot.
Right.
There's going to be gunshot residue on the injury.
If there's powder on the wound.
Right. Yeah. So right. So there's going to be gunshot right. residue on their hand. Or in this case, mm-hmm. you know, because he was put, the hand was put on top of a gun, mm-hmm. there could be gunshot residue on the gun and it could have gotten there from there. So even if it had mm-hmm. been a positive test, it would not have been meaningful in this case.
Not really, not necessarily. And Dr.
But
Howard
it was so negative, yes. which is what's so strange.
Dr. Howard
so
was asked about that, and he had performed, God, I don't know, it was 2,500 firearms tests in his career. And he said, look, it's probably easier to prove that someone did not fire a weapon than that they did. Because
right.
you can have a lack of gunshot residue. It doesn't mean that the person didn't fire the weapon. But if you find... But you have to test the weapon. It's weapon-dependent, and it's situationally-dependent. Like you've got, for example, you know, your example. If you've got a close contact wound, or you've got somebody who's within, you know, 4 feet of someone, and they shoot them, that's one thing. If they're shot with a high-powered rifle from a mile away, it's a little different thing.
Right.
And it's the amount. And the other thing that people constantly get wrong, and Dr. Burton said it in this case, and he had to know it was wrong. This combination of elements
right,
is not found in nature.
Antimony is not something you just find all the time.
Antimony, barium, and lead stifenate are right. not found together anywhere in nature.
Right.
It is specific to gunshot residue.
Right.
So it is not, and he said, well, these same elements are found on people. Well, no, they're not. They actually are not. And they're certainly, and it was the negativity of the levels that, in fact, we didn't even think gunshot residue was going to be an issue. We just said, look, and Howard, who had done this so many times and been around for so long, he said, well, you should check, let's test the weapon and see. And it was the weapon test, and then it was the
radical. And you
radical,
had the weapons,
and
which
had
we
the
don't,
weapon
always
you don't
have.
Always
yeah.
have. And
right.
you don't know if it's the same weapon. You don't know where it's been, what it's been through, but apparently this one was...
Boom. We knew.
He dropped right to the floor,
right.
and he fired it from right there, and it gives off... You could do this today. We didn't do it then. I've done it. I might have done it in the book. But you could actually do this digitally. You could recreate that image digitally and show it
mm-hmm.
in a recreation, and you see this cloud of
If you
this
have the time and money, yes.
If you have the time and money. surrounding this, the hand, and the arm, and the clothes, and all of that. There's no GSR anywhere near him.
Right.
It's just...
Right. Even if he had just handled the gun...
If he had handled the gun, right. Yes, it had just been fired, he probably would have picked up something.
Well, right. Even if he hadn't. I mean, you know, you do expect someone who is a responsible gun owner to clean their weapons, but not many of my defendants were responsible gun owners, and so you know you're going to have gunshot residue if the weapon's ever been fired. Most weapons, if they aren't cleaned regularly,
there's something around.
There's going to be
there's
on
a bit
there.
To it.
So
yeah.
if his hand had gotten on there, I would have been like, well, you know, it wouldn't mean anything to me from a prosecution standpoint that oh he fired the weapon. Not necessarily.
It didn't know. There was nothing to it, and you've got. And they asked it, they did it in trial one, they did it in trial two. And you got Larry Howard, and it's hard to convey how revered he was in this field.
Yeah.
Well,
and I knew you had Roger Perrion, too, and I knew
Roger Perrion, who's
quite well. He was a firearms expert as well.
He had tested the weapon here. So you got Roger Perrion, you got Randy Rydell, who ran that division. This is the same group in Atlanta that solved the Atlanta missing murdered children
right.
cases
right.
with fiber evidence
right.
that had never been used.
Well, so we could go on and on about what is happening with the attacks on forensic evidence, which is extremely upsetting.
But the point about the GSR stuff is it relates to something else. The reason that I think that Spencer would probably tell you that he wished he hadn't done it is it's similar to what happened in the early days with DNA evidence.
Yeah.
The explanation of it becomes so complex, particularly if they're willing to cross-examine things on it. They will cross-examine somebody about this stuff, about antimony and barium. By the time you look at and the mistake I think we might have made, now, maybe I didn't because I wasn't there. I believe it was the second or third trial that the state, because of scheduling, let off the trial.
I think you said it was the fourth one.
It might be the fourth trial. Yeah. Okay. Because I think Larry Howard wasn't available, or had a scheduling issue, they let off the trial with this stuff. So you were creating this thing that the jury's eyes are going to glaze over. In the early days, as you know, you had to figure out how to explain DNA evidence to people and the probabilities, because it's complicated. And if you get the wrong expert up there, they love to talk about it.
Right.
They'll go on for days about it.
Right. Well, and the reality is, from a strategic standpoint, how you tell your story matters, and you've got to get people's attention, and you've got to be able to tell it to them in a way that they understand it. And
it's hard.
Quite often you will see prosecutors do it not chronologically from an investigative standpoint, but chronologically from a how things happen standpoint,
right.
Because people can understand that. If you start off with, and I've read transcripts of other people who've done things this way, if you start off with, these are, the crime scene pictures of where the shell casings are, and you spend, days on, or half a day on that, you've lost your jury.
Yes.
And you've got to really work to get them back.
Well, you know this, I'm not telling you anything, but it's a terrific point, because a jury can follow a story. It's like I do, now I do film work and things and write a lot, and I'm not crazy about flashbacks. I think it breaks up a story, and I think it may be a cool device for some people. They sometimes overuse it.
Right.
But the problem is that it breaks up. I want to see the thing happen, because I can follow that, and I can get involved in it, and I'll go with you. I'll help you and say, I know what happened. Well, then they found these shell casings. It becomes a drama and a story that they love and they can follow. You start breaking this stuff up and putting it in the wrong sequence, it's confusing. Now, that is...
There are reasons to do it.
There are reasons you sometimes have to do it, and some things you have to put up first to establish certain things, but to get to the detail, but the defense loves this stuff.
Right.
The more confusion, particularly in a case like this, I think I've shared with you last time, and I don't remember if we recorded it or not, but something I was told by Judge Brandon, Perry Brandon, that his dad had told him, who was also a judge. About the myth of the Bobby Lee Cook myth, the somehow magical lawyers, these come in with superpowers and they just change everything and overcome the impossible, they win the... He says, my dad told me, he says, you let me pick my facts and I'll let you pick your jury. Give me the facts and I'm going to be good if I present them correctly. So if you get if you're in the defense side and these facts are not good, you've either got to change them, or you've got to throw some sand in their head, in their face, or you've got to confuse it, or come up with some muddy water, as you said, or cloud of something. Give you an example. And this is why, we won't go into all the detail on this, but there are a couple of things that happened. This is a good example of the change of tactics that people that tipped the head in the second trial. The photographs. Okay. Photographs of the scene. Sequence of events. The phone call comes in. Anderson, White, two or three other officers show up, 3 o'clock, 3 a.m. About 3:05, Donna Stevens, the ID officer, shows up.
And she's taking pictures.
She takes control of the scene, okay? Police officer, the patrol officers first, it's their scene. They put somebody at the door. She shows up, ID, forensics, they have the scene until detectives get there. She starts taking photographs. People are sent out of the room. There's nobody in there but her. She is photographing the scene as it was found.
Right.
All right. 3:30, Detective Reagan and Jordan show up. They then have control of the scene. All right. They ask her to start over. And she stopped wanting to start over. She didn't delete those, because it's film back in those days. So they, right. You know, she took what she took. But they start again, because mm-hmm. he wants certain things emphasized. He'll say, hey, I'll help you stop. Okay, let's, you know, take some more pictures with me, and while they process the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually photos, and you've seen them in the book. They're photos of, say, of him lifting up a TV guide to show what's under it. So she, mm-hmm. They're actually photographing the processing of the scene.
Right.
All right. Now we get to trial. And it's Sonny Siler. And he's got Donna Stevens on the stand. And what is he doing? He's asking her about the fact that, well, here too. And we gave him all the photos. She says, you know, you don't always do. We gave him everything.
Well, I mean, you. Okay, why not? Now you always do.
Back
then, they weren't entitled to them.
No. But we gave him everything. We know this case. Right. Take the photos. We're not hiding anything. Even though apparently I was hiding something I didn't know I was hiding. But in this case. So they go. So he goes through these photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a piece of paper on the desk. Yes. Well, it's in a different position in this photo than it is in the other photo. Yes, it is. He and she went back and forth about that. Who was in the room? Herd of elephants. People all over the place. This stuff's getting moved, because the problem is the place where the stuff really was did not help him. He needed to move these things.
Right.
And he needed to show movement on that desk, because maybe there's a way to get that those paper fragments on top of that pistol that
right.
Williams had used.
Right.
So it's all of this. And what he doesn't do with her, and I wish he had done, she did offer to do it. She offered to put them in sequence for him. She had proof sheets.
Oh, I would have done that on redirect.
I would have done that too.
Yeah.
And then what happened later, and I'll give you an example of how this can become a problem.
Mm-hmm.
This I did not find out until I went back through the transcripts.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is stuff you would not notice necessarily at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You got, I think it was Don Samuel or Kat, Austin Katz, has got Detective Reagan, who will be here. He's on the stand. He's going to ask him. Now, he didn't take the pictures, but he was there, right?
Right.
He doesn't like what he's getting from Donna Stevens, because she knows what he's up to. So he's going to try it with Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
So he does these things with Reagan. He hands him a photograph. And I think it was a chair. I think it was a position of the chair, of Williams' chair, to show like where it was at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
And has it marked as Defendant's Exhibit 19. He looks at it, admitted, fine, yes, that's a picture of the chair. Then he hands him another photograph, which he has marked as Defendant's Exhibit 20.
Mm-hmm.
Blah, 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 same chair,
mm-hmm.
in a different position.
Mm-hmm.
Look at this, it's in a different position. What is Reagan? He's like, I don't know. Yeah, well, we process a scene. I don't know what. Yeah, it looks like it's moved in that photo. He's not a photo guy. He's the detective. He's like, I can tell you what the picture looks like. Okay.
Right.
He did the same. They did the same thing with Detective Jordan when he got on the stand. And Detective Jordan was not even in the room when it was processed. He was in another part of the building. He did not process the scene with Detective Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
But they did the same photo thing. Now, here's the thing I found out, because I went back and looked at the proof sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Exhibit 19 was taken after Exhibit 20. Now, what is he doing? He's putting 19 in first,
right.
20 in second, to show to the jury, suggest to the jury that 19 was taken, then something happened and 20 was taken. 20 was taken before 19 was. He switched the order of the photos.
Right.
This is just an example. It's just one thing.
Right, and the movement of the chair was part of the normal process of the scene, so it wasn't
absolutely,
you know, some sort of nefarious something or other.
No, and here's the point that I make in the book, of course, is that Donna Stevens took photographs of the scene before the detectives ever got there. She was in there almost a half an hour, memorializing what the scene looked like when she showed up.
Right,
that doesn't change.
Right.
The fact that things are moved later and things that, yes, they're moved. They show them, they actually are, there are photos of them moving things while they're being done. So the other point would be, if this was a nefarious thing, then the police department has just documented their own tampering with the,
right.
It's so off the wall and insane. But what they're doing, what are they doing? They're trying to create doubt somewhere about something, and about who was in there and who moved that chair. The only explanation for the chair, and you know, I point this out in the book, the only, as you mentioned, there is a witness to this thing,
right?
It's Jim Williams,
right?
Never, ever did he ever mention the chair. Now, he couldn't for two reasons.
So even on cross-examination, y'all didn't want to touch it. It was like the third round?
He didn't know. He's like, I didn't pay any attention to it. I wasn't looking at the chair. I wasn't paying attention to the chair.
Okay.
Well, two reasons he can't have touched that chair. First, it meant that it had been turned over in the first place. Now, how did it get turned over? Because it's at the other end of the desk. Where this really happened. And there's more to that, which we haven't even touched on.
Right.
There, on that other end of the desk, where Danny, no doubt, was seated. And when we get to trial two or three, I get confused. Dr. Howard actually, in his reconstruction, he says, well, I think this is what happened. He was seated in that chair at the other end of the desk.
Right.
There is an ashtray on the desk. Mm-hmm. Next, and this is an antique. I even looked that up. I even tell you this is what century it was made in.
Right.
But it has a, which you don't get to do in trial, it has a leather top. Mm-hmm. It's ornate. It's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. There, next to the ashtray, in the leather top of the desk, is a joint that is ground out into the surface, into the leather surface of that desk.
And you believe what happened?
I believe they were having an argument. Mm-hmm. That Danny was seated in that chair with his feet up under it, mm-hmm. like you do, like I'm right. doing right now.
Right. Crossed.
Yes.
Because his feet are crossed in death.
And they're crossed in death. And he did this. This was in testimony from his friends. He picked at Williams on purpose all the time. He would get him mad because what would happen is Jim would do something bad. He would yell at him. He'd do something bad. He'd feel bad later and he'd get in something.
Like his car,
like the gold necklace that he gave Danny, that Danny then gave to his girlfriend, which just happened, by the way, right before this killing. So I think that has something to do with it. But Danny is seated in this chair. They have been to the drive-in. They've been out all night. They have been doing whatever they're doing. Williams claimed Hanford smoked 9 joints at the drive-in and drank a pint and a half of whiskey. Okay, whether he did or not, probably not, he'd be dead. But now he is dead, but not from that. I think he seated that thing. They get into a fight. They get into a fight so bad that they called Joe Goodman because it was supposedly about this trip to Europe.
Right.
They called Joe Goodman at 2, whatever time, I can't remember all the time frame, 2:05.
Earlier.
Earlier. And Danny got on the phone.
Goodman says, calm.
Danny, and he's calm. He says, right. Well, it sounds like Danny. He's slurred. You know, he's always just a little slurred. But yeah, it just sounded like regular Danny. Well, 20 minutes later, he's dead. Okay, so I think that he hung that phone up. That fight escalated. And I think Danny took the joint that he was smoking and ground it out in the top, in the leather top of that antique desk. And if you knew Jim Williams, that stuff, his material, his antiques, his furniture, his house was sacrosanct.
Mm.
I think Williams exploded and grabbed his gun. I think Danny jumped, stood up, which knocked the chair over backwards. And then Williams shot it in the chest. Now that bullet, unfortunately, didn't go through him.
Right.
So he shot him in the chest. He spun around. He goes to the ground. Williams shoots him again in the back of the head from the other side of the desk. And then he walks around the desk and shoots him in the back straight down into the floor. Here's another example of what the defense does. During cross-examination of their expert, they ask Joe Burton, mm-hmm. who would say anything, in my opinion, is it possible for Williams to have walked around the desk and shot Hanford after he was on the floor? No, because of the angle. And he shows why it wasn't possible. Well, guess what Burton does? Burton gets up and demonstrates. He walks counterclockwise around the desk.
Which is not where things were. Everything was on the clockwise side.
He went clockwise around the desk, stands over the body and says, see, you can't shoot him from here.
The counterclockwise direction, you can't.
Yes, okay. Because that's the way he went, right. In my opinion. He had to, because that works, but he doesn't show you the example that works. He shows you one that doesn't work.
Right.
But that's what I believe happened. His feet were at that end of the desk.
And you mentioned something about the chair having been knocked over. You know it was knocked over. Why?
Because it was on his pants leg. Howard had been moved.
Well, okay. But there was also a piece of skull, brain matter, or something like that.
Oh, yes. There's a piece of bloody skull on the seat of the chair.
And by the seat of the chair, you're talking about the part you sit on or the underside of it? Okay.
Part you sit on. And I believe it was leather, but I'm not positive. It was upholstered, so I think it was leather. But yes, found a segment of a little small microscopic bloody piece of skull on the chair seat, which means he couldn't have been sitting in it when the head shot was fired. Now, there's a lot of expert testimony in this thing. And the belief is that the second shot, which was to his head, and it tracks where the bullet's found, by the way. So we know that's where he was.
By the bullet, you're talking...
By the path through the head.
Right.
Because it went through the back of his head and into the floor.
Okay.
So that bullet and that hole were found. So we know the trajectory from behind the desk to that spot. The chair had to have been on its side and in a different position over there, where it would have been if it had been toppled over, mm-hmm. in order for that piece of skull to get stuck to the chair. There's another piece of skull up by the fireplace in that same direction. So we know that's the direction that shot went. And yes, right. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, the skull piece. So he wasn't sitting in the chair when he was shot.
Right. And there was one other thing, too, that you mentioned in the book about the chair's positioning. There were indentations in the carpet where it normally was.
Right.
And where it was found on over Danny's body, was that in alignment with those indentations?
No.
Okay.
So it had been moved. And, you know, I think the only scenario is that it had been toppled over. Williams had to pick it back up. He had to pick it up. Because if he didn't, none of this makes sense. Because he supposedly got him at the other end of the desk shooting at it.
Right.
He can't be down there. His feet are at that end.
Right.
The ashtray's at that end. The ground out joint is at that end, which never got talked about early on. It did in the second trial.
So
here we go.
So we've got a whole bunch of new experts saying new things about evidence and basically putting out a version of events that is inconsistent.
Absolutely.
With the actual evidence itself.
Anything they could think of. And it went on and it went on. The diagrams were wrong. The place is in the wrong place.
The second trial, and if I'm right about this, the second trial was like 9 days or something ridiculous?
It was. I wrote it down, actually.
Yeah,
because I was shocked. The first trial was, and these are trial days. The first trial, Williams 1, was 7 days. 7 days of trial.
Which is a lot for Savannah.
Which is a lot for what I call a simple murder case.
Right.
I mean, there really wasn't that much to it.
Right.
The second trial was 19 trial days.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's painful.
And it was taken up with this stuff, with all of this stuff that makes no sense.
That's exhausting.
They had no choice. I mean, I guess they have a choice, but it's picking at every single thing. It's calling a question, and I think we talked... Didn't we talk last time about the O.J. Simpson case, which was interesting?
We did. And I do find it interesting, but I want to keep focused on this a little bit.
Right, right. But the fact that the chairperson of the jury later says, well, that wasn't the reasonable doubt that we found.
Right. They were looking.
Looking for anything.
Right.
Something.
Right.
A doubt about any piece of the case.
Right. And so in this case, the second time around, one of the things that the experts do is they talk about the trigger pull.
Oh, yeah.
The gun and the weight of the trigger pull. And this is what ends up getting it reversed the second time. So that's why I'm bringing this up now. Can you tell us about what, and again, it's just mind-boggling that they would even do this, but they had some sort of example that they tried to use about the weight of the
Sonny
trigger pull?
Sonny Seiler actually went, they adjourned trial, and they went and brought in I think he brought that with him, a boat anchor. So, okay, here's the point about the trigger pull. The notion is, if, and anybody can kind of puts this in their own head and see this, you've got a desk, you're on one side of a desk, somebody's on the other side of a desk, you're, what, 6 feet away, 7 feet away at the most?
Right.
Okay. Supposedly, Danny Hansford is at that, is on the other side of the desk and has his arm extended with a weapon in it. So now he's, what, 4 or 5 feet from this, from Williams, and misses him by a mile. Hits the top of the desk somehow. Okay. It's absurd. All right. The only way, yeah, okay. So it works if you're setting it up. It doesn't work if you're really Danny Hansford. So, well, what could explain that? How could any human being be that off?
Bad of a shot, yeah.
What if pulling the trigger of the Luger itself pulls the barrel down? Ooh, what if it's got a really heavy trigger pull? Well, as you know, trigger pulls are adjustable and they're very different and they vary. So they get into this with Roger Perry, who you mentioned, who did the firearms testing at the Savannah State Crime Lab location. The trigger pull, and he tested it. And it was whatever it was. Well, let's see, that sounds like a lot. So Sonny Siler goes and brings in a boat anchor. And brings in a boat anchor to tie it to the thing. So he hands the anchor around to the jury members to see how heavy that is. Boy, that's heavy.
Which is a demonstrative that I would object to, but that's me.
Yeah, I think it's not connected to this case. It's an anchor in your hand. It is not a trigger pull because the fact is, and now I have to go back and look and see the detail, but either on Reader Ray or Roger Perry had tested this pistol.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think he was asked this, did you ever have any problem pulling the trigger?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no. So, yes, trigger pulls can vary.
Right.
But they don't stop the weapon from firing.
Well, right, and they also, we're talking about a weapon that Danny probably fired before. I mean,
So they said.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, theoretically, he's firing guns, like, all the time just for fun. It's not like he doesn't know how this gun works.
I know. And the truth is, it's another thing that doesn't matter if we know what really happened.
Right.
Because he didn't pull the trigger in the first place. Williams did.
So...
Here we go again. Obfuscation, diversion, anything you can come up with. I don't blame him. That's what you do. You have to.
Sure.
What else are you going to do? Stand up and say he did it? My client's guilty. You know,
right.
That's not popular in the defense world.
No, it's not. So they hand the anchor around. One of the things that does not happen is no one during the presentation of evidence, either direct, cross, state, otherwise, shows how this weapon actually fires. Shows
right.
it.
Right.
So what ends up happening that gets us reversed the second time?
Good question.
It involves Kathy Aldridge, I believe.
Oh, my goodness. You're right. Yes. I know what the court said. I forget, she did do this. She's this diminutive little... I mean, it was deceptive because she was strong as she... I mean, no, you would not want to tell you would get it. But if you just looked at her, she's this diminutive, tiny thing,
mm-hmm.
right? So she shoots it.
She dry fires it.
She dry fires it.
In court,
in
the
court,
gun.
In court.
But when does she do it? This is what they were fussed about, if I remember right. Was it in closing?
Might have been.
I think that that's
Probably.
What the issue was.
Whoa,
it wasn't during
okay.
the presentation of evidence.
Because I see nothing wrong. You know, I personally... think it's kind of cool, but
yeah, I know I can see where they're coming from. You shouldn't
they didn't
do it.
Have
in
a chance. They didn't have a chance to go back and look at it. I guess
right.
my thing about the second reversal was more about the ability of an expert to testify. This is some of the thing they went into that the court that they had never even raised.
Right. So part of the opinion, and it's actually dicta. It's not the basis for the reversal because they reverse based on that.
Right.
The thing that Kathy did. They do talk about experts,
and yes, they do.
We need to talk about that. So they mention what?
And it came back to bite them
right.
in the fourth trial.
Right. So what is it that the Georgia Supreme Court says that just adds exciting things to the later trials? Of
well, they basically said that if you can explain something without an expert, you can't use an expert. And that actually was already the law. But in this case, they applied it to investigative people. So like crime lab people, Detective Reagan himself, the chief investigator, couldn't draw conclusions from the evidence and tell you what it meant if you could have just explained it and the jury could have figured it out on their own.
Well,
that's
right.
That's a kind of shorthand way of saying it, but...
Right. And there are a number of issues with that, expert opinion that for a very long time. And we had a recent rules change. We are now using the federal rules in Georgia. Right. And so because of that, it is a lot more liberal as far as people giving opinions.
Okay.
Lay opinion and expert opinion are a lot broader. But you still have to lay a foundation, obviously.
You have to lay a foundation. And what the reason that it mattered so much and still matters is that not just to get the evidence in, not just to be able to allow them to reach an opinion and express the opinion, but they also gave greater weight to expert testimony. So in the old days.
Right, and so I think it's lesser now because everyone gives opinions, but right. Still.
It was important because they really put experts, if you were qualified and you had to qualify, you could be a course examined on your qualifications and all of this stuff to see if you are an expert. Now, in this case, for example, Joe Burton testified about things we'll get to about condensation in autopsies and about gunshot residue and about trigger. He's not a firearms expert and probably
right.
could not have qualified as a firearms expert.
Right.
But he testified anyway.
Right. And you have to have an area of expertise. And that was one of the things that I was finding really interesting reading through this. Like, how'd you get qualified to talk about that?
I happen to agree with you. I think today, if he was around, and he's not, but I think you'd want to go at him pretty heavily about his qualifications and his background and where he made his money and all of that, because it was he testified to things that, first of all, were just wrong scientifically, but he said them so fast and just said it so conclusively, and he made a good appearance. I mean, he was the epitome of, here comes the medical examiner who knows these things and has been in X amount of trials, but he didn't have the background. He certainly, as a firearms person, this happened with this GSR stuff with the lab and all that.
Well,
he was a medical examiner.
Right.
Where they had, I forget the testimony, I forget the area. Oh, it was this thing with the gun. So I'm thinking, Stone's going to come back. I'm reading the transcript. I'm like, Stone, who's the firearms guy from Dallas. Now, they set the foundation for this thing over here. They're going to bring Stone back, and he's going to testify about it. Well, Stone's already headed back to Dallas. They bring Joe Burton. Joe Burton walks in. I'm like, why is Joe Burton back? He's not a firearms person. And it was about photographs. It was about photographs and what a picture showed and what where the gun was. Is it the only thing that the picture had with firearms was that there was a gun in the photo? And he's not a firearms expert. But this stuff comes at you so fast, and I don't know. You tried a lot of cases. So you have to make a decision about, do you, like you said, do you follow them down the rabbit hole? Do you start complaining about every single thing? Or do you think that the person on the stand looks like a fool and nobody's going to buy what he says and you've already got your case won?
Right. It's a strategic thing. And it's really hard to say. I've not read the transcripts. I've read the opinions and I've read the books and whatever. But it is a hard thing to say what I would do in those circumstances in hindsight. For everyone, is
right.
2020.
Right.
My question when I was reading the books about this was, there's a suggestion to me, the fact that they called Burton to talk about this rather than calling Stone, the firearms expert, is that Stone wouldn't say it.
No, he wouldn't.
He's not going to say
no,
something that is scientifically inaccurate about firearms.
No. And I'll give him some kudos, which I actually do in the book. I don't know if they're kudos or not. They're sort of backhanded compliments. When he was challenged on something on cross, he would answer it correctly. And
right.
It took Kathy a while because she had a lot to go through. We said, well, that wasn't really evidence in this case, was it? Well, no, it wasn't. So this diagram is not accurately just depict the scene as it was. No, it isn't accurate. I didn't prepare it. It wasn't to scale. Williams prepared it, I think. I don't even know. But come on.
Nice.
He did do that. He would. So I agree. I think they were that any expert, and these are people who work for the state crime lab in Dallas. These were not private
right.
people.
Right.
And yes, they had a limit. They had a limit.
Well, because it can come back to bite you too as an expert. Like, it is much more common now, of course, to be able to get hold of a transcript
from prior cases. Absolutely.
From prior cases. But if you're on record saying something, and you're saying something is completely different, and the scientific basis should be the same,
right.
You're going to get ripped.
Right.
And a lot of people are,
yeah.
Especially in your softer sciences, your ID experts and things like that. So Yeah, but that's a separate area of discussion.
But yes, as to the firing of the weapon in front of the jury, I think it's very dramatic. You might see it on TV, but it probably would have been better having somebody else do it while they're on the stand.
Well, or just refer back to Perrion's, you know.
Did you have trouble? No, I had no trouble doing it.
Right.
I think she just wanted to say, hey, if I could do it, anybody could do it. But she wasn't on the stand. She wasn't testifying.
Right.
It's testimony.
Right.
It's
right.
Not...
Right, so I understand the basis for the reversal, but the extraneous language about experts was not great.
No, it was not.
And so you come back, I say you, thank God neither of us had got stuck having to come back a third time with this. They come back a third time.
Yes, they do. Here they go.
Mm-hmm. And
the problem I have an issue with the decision about experts.
I do too.
It's not really about experts. It's really about crime scene investigators, people who were there, who did this, who walked through it, who could tell you. I mean, I know you can go through and say, then you did this, and based on that, what did that cause you to do? I mean, you can take all day, and you can do that.
Right.
But when they've processed the scene, I can tell you that the reason Everett Reagan called me to come to the scene was because of what they saw.
Right.
When they went in the room.
Right.
A
this isn't
person
right.
off the street would not have seen what they saw and would not have interpreted it the way they did. And there are reasons why the interpretation matters. Like you just went through with the chair. It's over here. It's got to be over there because that's the angle of this. And as you know in the book, I got diagrams and I recreated all this stuff and angles of bullets and trajectories and all this stuff. But they don't understand how a person who doesn't do this every day, and I think that's something that's in the mind of maybe a Supreme Court justice who is in this business,
right,
is that these people have never been in here before. They don't do this for a living.
Right.
So things you think, now in your post-trial judgment, a normal person off the street might have understood or could have fully understood on their own. You really don't know that because you're not them.
Well, and you know, what we part of the thing that we deal with, or and I say we, I'm not in practice doing that work anymore, but as a prosecutor in the age of CSI...
Oh, yeah.
A lot of our time was spent, and I'm sure is still going to be spent going forward, disproving the crap that's on television. Because a lot of that is inaccurate.
Yes.
It's not even close to accurate. And so you can't get digging off of a blade of grass. That just
right.
doesn't happen.
Right.
So you have to explain to a jury that what you think you know, because we are also educated and we can Google things now,
mm-hmm.
What you think you know is not always accurate, and it might not be accurate to this case either. It might not be factually tailored to our facts.
And I would suggest that it's possible a jury member, even though they're told not to look at the media or anything else, may very well be wearing out Google at night.
And they right, and that is part of what we are. We're gotta fight everything, right?
I got an example from this case, in fact, on one of the ID officers who was brought in to testify, and he was cross-examined by the defense about, and Reagan, the rest of them were asked this, Donna Stevens was asked this, about did they take fingerprints? And her response was, this is a domestic case. They live here. We don't.
I expect their fingerprints to be everywhere.
Fingerprint. But there's a clock, an antique grandfather clock,
mm-hmm.
that was pushed over in on the floor in the foyer, not entrance hall. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did Danny push that over? Well, so he's asked about it. Did you fingerprint the clock? He says, no, I didn't fingerprint the clock.
Right.
it's an antique surface. So wouldn't that be a good place to have for fingerprints? Thinks he's going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're on CSI, you're thinking, oh yeah, they should have a fingerprint of the clock. Because mm-hmm. Now, there are two problems with this. First of all, thank goodness the guy says so, he says, well, it normally would be, but if it's been waxed or varnished, if there's a surface on it, it's been polished, then no, it doesn't work. Well, obviously that's furniture in William's house. It's been waxed and polished.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, the point I'm making in the book is, if Danny, we're trying to prove that Danny pushed the clock over, and that he was raging, he was destroying the house.
Mm-hmm.
He was creating all of this stuff.
Right.
Well, he may have.
Right.
That's not a reason for him to shoot Williams. That's a reason for Williams to shoot him.
Right.
It goes back to motive. But if you don't stop and think, okay, I see the cloud, but what does that cloud really, as you said it before, does it matter?
Right.
And what does it say about this case? Even if it's true, it's actually the wrong, it's not a defense argument, it's a prosecution argument.
Right.
Danny was going crazy, he lost it, he starts busting up his furniture, he's sitting in that place and he squeezes that right. joint out in this thing, and Williams finally lost it.
Right. It's all of the things that they try to point to as, you know, Danny being this wild man are reasons for Williams to shoot him, not reasons for Danny to be, you know, an aggressor.
That was their problem. That was their big problem in this case. He was the golden goose for Danny Hansford. Danny had no reason in the world to shoot him and kill him.
Right.
Now there was, you know, we get to later with the affidavits that came in and these crazy people.
And that was mostly, was it after the second appeal?
It was a motion for new trial in two.
Oh, in two. Yes. Yeah. Oh, so we haven't talked about it. We've talked about the appeal, but we have not talked about the motion for new trial, in part because the appeal doesn't touch any of that.
None of it. Never came up.
So let's talk about this trial. We're going to have coffee in a little bit, but we can.
Williams, too. After, as you said before, after the verdict, then it's routine. Motion for new trial. The judge says, nah, deny it. Off you go to the appeal.
Usually.
And there's a side piece to this, by the way, and that is that Williams is in jail now because he was convicted and there was no appeal bond.
Right. So after the first one, he got an appeal bond, and so he's out in the world doing Jim Williams things.
Right.
After the second one, Judge Oliver says, you got to stay in jail.
Right. So there's a motion for new trial. Now, the only thing that, I mean, there's just no way. You have to somehow say that there was some error in the trial, the judge did something wrong, but there was some prosecutorial or something, or the magic thing, newly discovered evidence.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. For newly discovered evidence, it's very difficult to find because, first of all, it has to have been something that you could not have discovered with reasonable diligence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't have found it out. You have to be able to argue that it would have changed the result in the trial.
Right.
And that it's something else. What's the third
one? I think it's actually, there are four Timberlake factors, and I should know what they are off the top of my head, and I don't remember.
Well, those are the two big ones.
Right. I mean, it has to have been discovered since the trial.
Oh, that's it. It has to actually be new.
It has to actually be new.
It has to have been discovered since the trial. It couldn't have been discovered sooner, and it would have materially affected the verdict. It would have changed the outcome.
Right.
Okay. That stuff is like, I don't know if it's like a Michigan fan of an Ohio State rally. It just doesn't happen. You don't.
Right.
It just isn't.
Right.
No. Well, guess what? Here comes affidavits.
And there are a lot of
avalanche of affidavits.
There are a lot of them.
There were like two dozen.
Wow.
It was one after another, after another, after another, being filed by Katz and Sonny Seiler. Another piece to this in that when you file these affidavits, these are sworn affidavits under oath filed in a pending case.
They are
subject to perjury, prosecution.
Right.
The lawyers filing them also have to file an affidavit of their own certifying those three points we just made, that this is stuff that we could not have found, it's brand new, and it would have changed the outcome in our opinion. They file those also under oath. Those are subject to prosecution for perjury. I don't know if it's ever happened.
I don't know.
But they are vouching for these affidavits. All right, here come the affidavits.
And in fact, I'm just going to put this in there. I don't think the attorneys have to do the affidavit thing anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
They did then, and they filed it.
Yeah, I don't think they did.
Along with the affidavits. So here comes the affidavits. And here, the affidavits in some, and we'll talk about one in particular, but generally what they are saying is that Danny Hansford, now remember when this is years later, that Danny Hansford had been bragging to people, telling people that he didn't even know at a party or at wherever it was, that he was planning to kill Williams and take his money.
There's an inherent problem with that,
yes,
which
is
that it's not like his money is sitting there in the house accessible.
I don't think Danny was in his will.
No.
And I don't know that you can inherit if you kill the person, but...
Well, and most of the money is investments. I mean, and it's in the bank. It's just like all of the things.
How was he going to get his money?
That's ridiculous.
It's also being said by people who didn't know Danny Hansford at all.
Well, right, and that's the bigger problem.
There's one in particular that's really interesting. Well, actually, there are two that are interesting. One of them was filed by somebody, you know, people in Savannah would know. He used to work at a men's clothing shop, and he had known Sire all his life, and he told a story about how Danny had come to his house, and he had stayed over, and he had told him all this stuff about how he was going to kill Williams. Okay. Now, there was a second one, and I'll go ahead and we'll do them together. So what happened is, what Spencer Lawton did was brilliant. Well, you do that, but it's what he did. Another one was a fellow who was in the jail at the time. And he testified that he had this affidavit that he also had known Hansford, and that Hansford had told him at a party that he was going to kill Williams and take his money, blah, 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 blah. Okay, those are these two. The first one, by the friend of Siler, what the DA's office did then, what Spencer Lawton did, when all these affidavits are flowing in from God knows where, is he sends investigators, J.D. Smith,
mm-hmm.
and Roger Stone.
Well, who was with the GBI, right?
He was with the GBI at the time. He got pulled in because there were some allegations later about some money might have passed some hands, so he brought in the GBI. So J.D. Smith goes to interview the people that signed the affidavits. Says, here's what it says in your affidavit. Is that what happened? Once there's some money alleged to have passed hands, then here comes Roger Stone. So the two of them go, and they talk to these people. They talk to the guy who was the haberdasher. Well, it says in this affidavit that you said that Danny Hansford said that he was going to kill Williams. Did you say that? Well, no, I didn't say that. He said he was mad at Williams for having thrown him out of the house, because I guess in April he got mad and made him go away for a while. But your affidavit says that something's there. Well, yeah, but I didn't say that. Well, how is it that it says this here? Did you read this thing before you signed it? He says, well, I didn't read it really that carefully. Besides, I have cataracts, and I don't see that well. I mean, this is going to get kind of funny, actually. You have cataracts, you don't see that well. Okay? So you didn't really read it, but somehow it got filed, and it's now in a court.
Right.
Okay, off they go. Now, the other one is the fellow who's in the jail. He says Hansford told him the same thing. Okay, fine. They go to see him in the jail. J.D. goes first to talk to this kid. He walks in the door, and the kid is pissed. He says, all right, this guy, he is... And J.D. comes back, and all of these things are filed under affidavit as well. So everything Stone said, and you know, he told me that, are other affidavits. So J.D.'s in his affidavit. He goes to the jail. This guy is very irritated. And he's like, well, what's up? Why are you so upset? He goes, well, he was supposed to get $500 for filing the affidavit. And then if Williams got a new trial, he would get another $500.
And this is supposed to come from Williams.
It was supposed to come from Siler.
Oh.
And he says, and that son of a bitch, Siler, stiffed me.
So he's mad.
Oh, he's mad. Because he didn't get paid.
Nice.
Okay. Now, what happens? Well, J.D. Smith comes back and he files an affidavit saying, here's what I was told. Statement, okay? Took a statement. Same thing happens over here with the haberdasher. Statement. They supply those to the defense. And there are others.
I think there were some other people at the jail.
Everybody they could find, they interviewed. And they filed their affidavits based on whatever they were told on the follow-ups and all that kind of stuff. But these are the two good ones. So what do you do when you get that? Now you've got this affidavit saying that I went to the jail, and this guy's mad because Siler didn't pay him the bribe he was supposed to have paid it. Oh, that's not good. So I'm thinking, okay, what would you normally do if I'm the defense attorney? I'm going to say, Joe Schmo in the jail is full of it. I don't know who the hell he is, and I don't know what he's talking about. Now, you have already filed an affidavit under his name in the case, so you definitely know who he is.
Right.
Anyway, no, they don't do that. They file a new round of affidavits. In the case of the guy in the jail, they file another affidavit from him. Oh, I left something out. After the J.D. Smith story about going to visit him, Roger Stone comes into the case from the GBI because of the allegation that there was a bribe that was supposed to be paid.
Right.
Okay. He goes to interview the same guy in the jail.
Stone does.
Stone does. And records it. Okay?
So it's audio recorded.
Audio recorded.
And he says the same thing
story.
To Stone.
Same thing to Stone. I didn't get paid, that son of a bitch. Same thing to Stone. All right. So now we're caught up. Okay. Second round of affidavits. Here comes another affidavit from the same guy. And it says, not only is everything he told J.D. Smith and Stone a lie, he made it up, but that they had all agreed that it was going to be a lie, including the recording was going to be a lie.
So J.D. and Roger Stone
right.
and this guy in the jail that yeah. they're just friends with, I guess.
Yeah.
Are all agreeing about
conspiracy.
That.
Conspiracy. Because he wanted to be, what was it? He was on hold for a charge somewhere else, and Ralph told him, he promised him if he lied about Williams that he would get him transferred to something he made up. Okay. And claimed that he couldn't have cooked this up with Williams because he didn't barely even knew the man. And they never saw each other in the jail. They were in different sections. That's a whole different part of the book. Completely wrong, and
right,
and the sheriff was in on it. But anyway,
right,
off
but,
we go.
But they.
So and, the second one does the guy, the haberdasher, another affidavit from him.
Yeah,
all of that was made up. They made up everything. I never said any of that stuff to them. I never said any of this stuff to them. And so my comment is, well, how did they know about his cataracts?
Right. Yeah, I mean,
anyway. So the affidavits back and forth, back and forth. Finally, Judge Oliver put he came up with a date, and he says, here's the date. No more affidavits. And it turned out, and Spencer will know exactly, but I think it was 18. It was a
yeah, David might know as well.
Number.
Yeah.
David would know of these affidavits. So then you go, you think, well, this is crazy. They didn't even know these people. Well, now they got a note. Somebody delivered it to Spencer. He'll know this. You get a copy of a note that Williams had written to the kid in the jail saying, hey, we got these many affidavits. We're going to get some more. It's all going great. Everything's going to change. The DA's really out over a limb or whatever the words were. Now they're like, we're going to change everything for all of us. You know, best regards, Jim. Like, well, they don't know each other, apparently. Oh, well, maybe they do. So Judge Oliver finally gets to decide the motion for a new trial and found none of the affidavits to be credible, which is interesting, considering yeah. that the attorneys filed their own saying that they were true and they could not have been found. Besides, you know, mm-hmm. by this time, this thing had been in the paper. And you're telling me none of these people knew about it. None of these yeah. people knew to come forward. Could not have been found before this.
Right.
The haberdasher said, well, I was out of town, and I really wasn't paying that much
what,
attention
to What, for 4 years?
It. Yeah, apparently. Apparently.
Okay. Or 5 years, or whatever it was at that point.
So here we go. So now, all this wasted time, but the fact that they would even do that,
yeah,
it's just this concocted. There is this. Oh, I only should. I probably shouldn't even bring that up. But there was a case in federal court where Mr. Seiler was found by the judge to have filed a false affidavit in a case, and blah 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 blah. So I don't. You know,
this,
I'm not
saying
this about. I don't
think he's the first attorney that would have done that.
I don't either, and I think it's too bad. Because there should be a line somewhere, but I swear it's hard to find sometimes when you're in the haberdasher, for example, said that he had known Sonny all his life. He'd known him since he was a kid. That he himself had been drunk at the beach at one point, and Sonny was a lifeguard, and he had, I don't know if he was a lifeguard, but he was at the beach, and that he had pulled him out of the waves and maybe even saved his life. And he had called, and he'd known his mother. His mother was his teacher in school or something else. I don't know, whatever it was. And Sonny basically called him and said he needed a favor and told him this was the most important case of his life. He became, everybody does, become obsessed with winning. And you can, hopefully you don't do things you shouldn't be doing, but you lose sight of it. But some of this stuff with these affidavits, they were obviously fabricated. And I go to such detail, you mentioned detail. There's mm-hmm. so much detail in this book.
Right.
I went to look at the affidavits. Mm-hmm. I read them myself. All right. And you look at, if you've ever done, well, you have probably, word processing.
Yes.
You'll notice there is a certain style, the way you format paragraphs, mm-hmm. whether you use the number one or you spell it out or you don't. There's a certain way. All of those affidavits that were the really suspect ones were exactly the same format, and they had the same footers on them, mm-hmm. so they were prepared in the same office. They weren't prepared by these people.
Oh, no.
No. They were prepared by the law firm.
Right.
And they have legalese in them. If you read the one from the guy in the jail, this kid in the jail, it sounds like it was written by a law school professor. And you know that's not true.
Right. Well, and they aren't... Yeah. The affidavits that I have seen rarely are in the words of the person who signs them.
No. No, they're not. They should attach it. They should record it, transcribe it, attach it as an exhibit, and that's them talking. But it's crafted in a way to right. make the case. But it's also in these cases, stuff that's made up. That's disturbing. So off the case goes. Bingo. Now you're going to file the appeal. So it goes up.
It comes
and
back.
Off it goes, and it comes back again.
Right. I know these conversations with Deb get very detailed, but it's hard to understand everything that got manipulated with this case without getting into the weeds. Believe it or not, we haven't even made it to the fourth trial, the acquittal, and Deb dug deep on that too. I will come back to Deb in episode 5, but before that, I had another exclusive. I got to talk to David Locke on the record about this case. David taught me a lot about being a prosecutor, and even more about why prosecutors play their cards close to the chest. Join us for episode 4. On behalf of Inside the Bar, I want to thank a whole lot of people who helped me come up with ideas for this show and have contributed to my ability to even put it together. Probably number one on this list is Jim Ogletree, whose music you get to hear. The piece that is included in this show is Glimmer of Hope, which is fantastic. You can get more of Jim's music by following Glimmer of Hope on Instagram, and also by checking out, I believe it's SoundCloud.